Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, it's a lightning palooza. We're going to meet the researchers who are probing the high voltage mysteries of our atmosphere. You think you knew everything there was about lightning? Oh, no. We'll talk about what's still left to know. But first, this week, the Trump administration announced it would change the way the Endangered Species Act is implemented starting in September. Regulators would soon be able to conduct economic assessment to decide whether a species should be protected or not. The legislative overhaul would not only make it easier to take species off the endangered list, but it would also weaken protections for ones that remain on the list. Joining me now to talk about that and other stories from the week in science is Maggie Kurth Baker, senior science reporter at 538. Welcome back, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is a new way of evaluating endangered species, different from what we already have in place, right?
Right. So historically, the process of adding animals onto the Endangered Species Protection Act list has been really all about scientific evidence. You know, what data suggests that the species is in danger? How endangered is it? How important is it to the functioning of the ecosystem? That kind of thing. But now under these new rules, the regulators will also be allowed to consider cold hard cash, like the money that a timber company might not make if it can't cut trees in a certain patch of forest. And these regulations, they also now change the timelines so that the risks have to be in the quote-unquote foreseeable future, which is this kind of vague designation that could really be used to prevent protection from longer-term risks.
So I imagine that scientists are not very happy about this.
No. Some of the scientists have said that under these new timelines, for instance, it would be almost impossible to designate the polar bear as endangered because the sea ice loss in the Arctic is a longer-term problem than a short-term one.
Oh, details, details. Let's move on to the next one. The first human CRISPR clinical trials are starting in the U.S. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So this week, the scientists announced the beginning of these first official clinical trials. They're going to be using CRISPR to treat blood disease, cancer, and inherited blindness. And you probably are remembering that last year there was a Chinese scientist who had announced that he'd edited the genes of embryos using CRISPR technology. These trials are different than that. For one thing, they're being done in adults and children, not embryos. So these changes that are being made aren't things that could be inherited or passed on to future generations. And of course, there's also the whole like legitimacy aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, this is having ethics oversight and transparency, and it's not secret under the table experiments. But we still don't know how well this is going to work. Science News's Tina Hessman-Say had a really good article where she pointed out that, other kinds of promising genetic therapies haven't turned out to be useful in practice as they were in theory. You know, people have died during gene therapy trials, and in one case, treatment seemed to help blind people see better, but then the effects didn't last.
So this is going to be targeted at first for blindness?
One of the things it's going to be targeted at is blindness and also blood disease and cancer.
Mm-hmm. Any concerns about there may be off-target? You know, the CRISPR's had problems with that.
Yeah, that is definitely a concern. And it's something where there's a lot of experimentation. You know, we have a lot of these things that work pretty well in theory, work pretty well in mice, and then you get into humans and it's something else entirely.
Let's move on to Colombia. This is a story we've been talking about for years. It seems to be finally happening that Colombia has a state of national emergency about bananas.
Right. So the past is prologue in the fruit industry. Back in the 1950s, we lost nearly the entire banana industry when a fungus came through and killed off whole plantations. It completely shifted the way we eat bananas. We use a different variety now than your grandparents did. And it seems like the same thing is happening. There's this fungus called Tropical Race 4 that has killed trees all over Asia and Africa. And it was first reported in Latin America and Colombia in June. And now those infections have been confirmed. And if you like bananas, this should be a pretty scary thing. There's no known resistant variety to replace the current banana that we use. And this Tropical Race 4 fungus, it can live in soil for decades. So once a plantation is infested, it's pretty much done for.
Because we all use one banana, right? Just about everybody eats the same, the same banana.
This is a function of monoculture. You know, there have started to be different other varieties of bananas that have turned up in stores in recent years. But predominantly, we are using one variety of banana that is grown on hundreds of thousands of acres of land, and that makes it kind of an easy target for illness.
And there's no way to really stop the fungus, right?
No, there's not. It spreads incredibly easily. This is kind of one of those things where even walking in an infected plantation and then going to a different plantation could spread it.
The Cavendish banana may be soon gone. Wow. I maybe we'll get some of those little bananas.
I like the little ones.
Yeah, they're very tasty. I mean, who eats the whole banana? Okay, well, I'm moving on to our last topic. There was an article from Live Science that said the communities with the oldest people in the world, like Sardinia and Italy and Okinawa, might not actually be as old as we think they are. What's going on there?
So I'm sure you've heard about the blue zones, you know, these places where lots of exceptionally old people live. And there's been all of these studies about what are they eating, how are they living, how can we replicate what they do. And there's this recent study that came out that was finding that these blue zones, these places, not only have some of the oldest people in the world, they also have lower than average life expectancies for everybody else. So you have this combination of a few extremely old people and then a lot of people who aren't living as long as other places that don't have the extremely old people. And that's starting to make some researchers sort of wonder what's going on. And one of the theories is that this could be an issue of faulty record keeping or even outright fraud. So the examples that they're sort of bringing up around this are that, you know, in the United States, we used to have a ton of supercentenarians, like these people who lived past 100. But as we got better record keeping state by state, the number of supercentenarians dropped dramatically. So in each state, the number of people over the age of 110 dropped by 69% to 82% when birth records started being kept better for those states. And that could be part of what's going on, because when you're talking about supercentenarians right now, you're still talking about people born before modern record keeping. There's also transcription errors that could be happening. There's also fraud that could be happening. So earlier this year, for instance, there was an investigation that looked into the story of Jeanne Calment, who was supposedly 122 when she died in France and has kind of long held this record of the oldest living human. But this new research suggests that she might have actually been the daughter of the real Jeanne Calment, who took over her mother's identity to get a pension. So there are lots of reasons why we might be reporting people as older than they actually are. And so a lot of this research into blue zones may or may not actually be all that useful for anyone.
Wow. As I say, details, details. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maggie Kurth-Baker is senior science reporter at 538. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. You know, if you live in an urban environment, urban electric scooters are the latest rage from L.A. to Austin to Atlanta. People are scooting to get around. These things are electric by every stretch of the word. And there's no gas guzzling involved. And it's got to be good for the environment, right? Well, a new study in the journal Environmental Research Letter says not quite. Sigal Samuel is here to fill us in. She's a staff writer for Vox in Washington. Sigal, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us about what's the bad news about electric scooters?
Well, I'm sorry to be the purveyor of bad science news, but unfortunately, this study seems to show that scooters are actually worse for the environment than the modes of transportation that they're displacing.
Ooh, give me the details, please.
So, you know, the scooters themselves don't actually emit carbon dioxide or anything, so they're good in that sense, and they're certainly better than driving a car. But the researchers basically analyzed the life cycle of a scooter, so what it takes to manufacture them, transport them around a city, the whole life cycle. They found that most of the harm to the climate comes from manufacturing the scooter and from transporting it around the city, because at night, after we've dumped our scooters on the curb, these people called juicers or chargers are tasked with driving them around the city, you know, gathering them up in cars, which of course use gasoline, and then repositioning these scooters in places where people will ride them in the morning after they've been recharged.
So you're negating the whole idea by driving them around the city.
Unfortunately, it's a pretty inefficient way to do this.
Is there any good news about the scooters? Any good thing that's going on?
Well,
they are better than cars, right?
They are better than cars, and the study isn't all doom and gloom. It does make some concrete recommendations about how we could make scooters a legitimately green option, which, you know, for example, could include allowing scooters to remain in public areas overnight so that they don't need to be moved around by car even when they're 95% charged. We could also incentivize the use of efficient, you know, electric vehicles to collect and redistribute them. We could streamline the collection and redistribution so that the juicers and chargers aren't wasting all this gas as they zigzag around the city trying to find scooters to collect. You know, so there are some concrete things we could do to make this a green option. It's just right now, it's not actually a greener option than, say, riding a standard bus with a high ridership or riding a bicycle. And when the researchers looked at surveys, they found that half of the people riding scooters say that they would have biked or walked if scooters weren't available. And of course, biking or walking are better for the environment than scooters.
And I'm sure the scooter companies are responding by saying something wrong with the study or whatever.
Exactly. Lime actually responded to the study and said, "We think the study is based on assumptions and incomplete data." But actually, the study is pretty consistent with some previous research on scooters, so it does appear to be pretty sound.
I have my own solution. You know, we leave scooters around, we take them home, we charge them, we plug them in, and then we get a credit on our electric bill so everybody can take a scooter.
Yeah, that's a pretty good idea, actually, and that's how private scooters work, so, you know.
You know, I'm not a genius, but it's some things are a little easier. Thank you, Seagal.
My pleasure.
Seagal Samuel is staff writer for Vox based in Washington. We're going to take a break and come back. Everything you wanted to know about lightning, plus some things researchers are still mystified about. Give us a call, 844-724-8255. What would you like to know about lightning? 844-724-8255. We will have everything we can think about, and we'll be talking about it with Amy Nordrum, who's going to join me as a co-host for a while. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know how the saying goes, where there's thunder, there's lightning. Because as you know, lightning's super hot flashes create the shockwave that we hear as thunder. Oh, I love that sound. You know, you would think all these centuries after Ben Franklin captured lightning in a bottle that we would know everything about it. But you know what? Lightning is more complicated and mysterious than what old Ben could have imagined. Or what you might have learned in grade school, like lightning's just a buildup of charge grounding itself, right? Well, it's really not that simple. Researchers are still puzzling out what initiates the actual bolt, which ones are the most dangerous, and how can we predict lightning to protect people and structures. A lightning bolt is more than meets the eye. Why does it flash? Why does it branch? Why does a lightning flash sometimes start from the bottom, starting in tall buildings or structures and flashing up into the atmosphere, plus a few other mysteries? Our friend Amy Nordstrom, news editor at the IEEE Spectrum, has been reporting in depth as scientists work to map the mysteries of lightning. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Ira.
She's here to help me as my voice goes away. It's good to have you here this week. If you have a question, our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, or as usual, you can tweet us at SciFry. Let me bring in one of the researchers from Santis Tower. Dr. Farhad Rashidi is a professor at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne, Switzerland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Hi, Ira. Hi, Amy.
Amy.
Hi.
What would you get us started here?
Yeah, Farhad, so what do we know about how lightning forms in storms and what triggers it to strike?
Lightning is an electric discharge, the same kind of discharge that occurs when you walk across a carpet, and charges are separated by friction. And when you get close to an object like a doorknob, there is a discharge. And so these extra charges return to the ground. So lightning is to some extent similar to this phenomenon, except that its path length is a few kilometers. It's kind of a gigantic electrostatic discharge, which basically discharges two electrically charged regions, either in the atmosphere or from a point in the atmosphere and the ground.
And why does it happen?
Of course, yeah.
Why does it happen in some storms but not every storm?
Because lightning requires that charges, positive and negative charges, be separated in the cloud. And this happened in some of the clouds, and in which there is an electrification process which occurs, which is quite complex, following some convection processes, which is still being studied by scientists. So basically what happens is that there are these updrafts and various particles in the cloud collide to each other, and charges get separated. So typically you have ice crystals which become positively charged and move upward, and the lower part of the cloud becomes negative, which is some kind of a mixture of ice and water. And so you need to have this charge separation, and this separation of the charge will generate an electric field. And it is when this electric field exceeds some kind of a specific threshold, then it creates a breakdown and leads to the initiation of the lightning discharge.
Now, Amy, I understand that you got started studying lightning because of a special tower that has an affinity for lightning bolts, it turns out.
Yes, actually, this is a site called Santis Tower, which Farhad is very familiar with. That's how I originally started learning about it. You know, I write for a publication that covers a lot of electronics and electrical technologies, but we're always writing about electricity that, you know, we produce and generate and distribute. And, when I stumbled across the Santis Tower research, I realized, well, this is, you know, lightning is its own electrical phenomena that we really don't have that much to do with. And this mountaintop tower in the Swiss Alps is struck by lightning more than 100 times a year, possibly more frequently struck than any other object on the planet. And Farhad and his team have instrumented with all kinds of different gadgets to be able to understand and study lightning better.
Well, so what is the most mysterious, what's the most mysterious thing to you that we still don't know about how lightning works?
Yeah, well, as you said, more than 250 years ago, Benjamin Franklin demonstrated with his famous kite experience the electrical nature of lightning. And nearly 300 years after, and despite lots of studies and considerable progress also, lightning remains enigmatic and not fully understood. And what is interesting is that even the very initiation of the lightning discharge is not quite well understood. If I can summarize the thing, is that in order to have lightning initiated, you need an electric field exceeding a critical value. And this value is about 1.5 million volts per meter at the altitude of about 5-6 kilometers. Now, the problem is that despite extensive measurements, either using balloons, aircraft, rockets, etc., fields inside the cloud have rarely exceeded 200,000 volts per meter. That is one-tenth the required field. And of course, some explanations have been proposed by scientists to solve this puzzle. For example, that it's possible that stronger fields exist only in a relatively small region, which make them difficult to measure. But there is another interesting discovery some 20, 30 years ago, back in 1990, so it's quite recent, where it has been demonstrated that lightning emits high energetic radiation. Actually, lightning is quite unique. I mean, there is no other phenomena, neither in nature nor man-made, that produce electromagnetic fields in so wide spectrum, from very low frequencies to radio frequencies to microwave and X-rays and gamma rays. And these studies have shown that the energies of X-rays and gamma rays can be quite high, even much higher sometimes than the energy of a chest X-ray. And this actually is interesting because it suggests the existence of energetic electrons, which are moving extremely fast. And what is interesting is that there is a different type of discharge, which is called runaway breakdown, which requires indeed a smaller electric field of about 200,000 volts per meter, which is consistent with the data and which involves these energetic electrons. So this has been basically an important discovery in order to better understand the initiation of lightning, but still there are many obscure points, as for example, what are the seed particles that are producing, that are needed to produce this kind of specific breakdown. So I would say there are lots of things that are still unknown and people working on them, but even the very initiation of lightning is still a mystery today.
Let me bring on someone who works exactly, good segue for me, Farhad, because I want to build on, bring on a researcher who works on understanding where lightning comes from, and that is Bill Ryson. He is a professor of electrical engineering at New Mexico Tech in Albuquerque. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, thank you.
What do you, you know, you were listening. Do we still not understand how lightning starts?
We're starting to understand better how that happens. Farhad talked about one mechanism as being what's called relativistic runaway electron avalanche, in which electrons are accelerated in a smaller electric field but are still able, through relativistic properties, to gain the necessary energy to start a discharge. However, our research, if you were to see that, basically the discharge would propagate in the direction that the electrons are moving, which is in the opposite direction of the electric field. Our research is showing that the breakdown propagates in the direction of the electric field, opposite the direction the electrons are moving. So it's probably not relativistic runaway electron avalanche. It's something that you can't produce in the lab, because in the lab you can't get such strong fields over the distances needed, but it's a system of streamers. A streamer is a electrical discharge which doesn't actually heat up the air but just frees electrons, and it propagates, the positive breakdown propagates in the direction of the electric field, which is not what the relativistic runaway electron avalanche would predict.
And Bill, do we know what might stir up these small pockets of more powerful electric fields and cause these breakdowns to form in the first place?
Well, it's not really a small pocket of a field. It basically is a field which probably extends 500 meters or so in distance. And it's just something that we haven't seen in the lab, because we can't in the lab produce the conditions which are produced in the thundercloud to get this. Mm-hmm. So while we still don't really understand the mechanism for how exactly this works, we now have seen the evidence of what's going on, and now theoreticians are trying to get a better understanding of what physically is happening.
Let me go to the phones because a lot of people have so many questions. Let's go to Oregon. Mike, hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hi there, Mike. Are you there?
I'm here.
Go for it.
Hello. How are you this morning?
Fine.
I live in La Grande in Northeast Oregon, and I'm a lookout for the U.S. Forest Service. And I understand lightning, cloud-to-cloud lightning, and I understand lightning that comes out of the cloud and strikes the ground. The last weekend, we had massive lightning storms that lasted for hours, last Friday and Saturday, including a lot of lightning that came as tendrils from the cloud and never struck the ground. And I don't understand that. I don't understand the science behind it, because I thought they all either struck the cloud or stayed in the cloud. So if I get an explanation for that, I would appreciate it.
All right, Bill. Bill, can you fill us in on what is the difference between cloud-to-cloud lightning and cloud-to-ground lightning?
There's really no difference in terms of the actual physical mechanism. Basically, lightning tries to go from one region of charge to another region of charge. And that charge can either be inside the cloud or it can be in the ground. And lightning finds the easiest way to get from one point to the other. So if the easiest point is from one charge region of the cloud to another charge region of the cloud, it will stay entirely within a cloud. It can go from one cloud to another cloud. It can go from the cloud outside of the cloud and die before it goes anywhere else, or it can go from the cloud to the ground, or it can go from the cloud up into the ionosphere.
I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking about lightning today, our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Amy Nordstrom, news editor at the IEEE Spectrum, who loves lightning herself, is here to join me.
Yeah, I actually used to be terrified of thunderstorms when I was growing up. I was always really scared of them and run into my parents' room and sleep there whenever they happened. And I'm mostly over that now, but I'm totally fascinated by it. So Farhad, we were speaking a little bit about the different types of lightning that can occur. I know upward lightning is the most common type of lightning that happens actually at Santos Tower where you're doing your work. So tell us a little bit about that and what some of the other ways are that scientists classify lightning.
Exactly. So most of the lightning flashes actually occur within the cloud. And I mean, we believe like maybe 75% of lightning discharges occur within the cloud or in between the clouds. And about 25%, they terminate their path to ground. And these are called cloud-to-ground lightning. And cloud-to-ground lightning, they can be classified in terms of their direction of propagation and also in terms of the charge that they are carrying to the ground. So they can be downward negative and positive. So that means that they initiate from inside the cloud and they move towards the ground, and they carry either negative or positive charges. So actually it happens that about 90% of cloud to ground flashes are downward negative, probably because the lower part of the thunder cloud is charged negatively, so there is more chance that this type of lightning is more likely to occur. And about 10% of cloud-to-ground lightning flashes are downward positive.
That means it starts on the ground and goes upwards?
Actually, downward negative and positive, they start in the cloud and go down. And one can see actually when you look at the lightning discharge, you can see the direction, whether upward or downward, by looking at the direction of the branches. Now, if you look images of lightning, or the next time you are in the middle of a thunderstorm, you will see that most of the lightning flashes, the direction of the branches are downward, and this indicates that most of the lightning flashes are downward, except when you have very tall structures. So when you have very tall structures, then you can have, let's say, an upside down lightning or an upward lightning, in the sense that lightning is initiated from the ground and developing upward. And this is called upward lightning, and it is only produced from the tip of tall objects, typically 100 meters or taller. So for instance, in New York, where you are, so most of the lighting discharges to Empire State Buildings or other tall buildings are upward flashes. Or if you look at other pictures of lightning to some tall structures like, I don't know, Eiffel Tower in Paris or CN Tower in Toronto, they are upward flashes. That means that they are initiated from the structure itself. And this is a quite new type of lighting. I think maybe 150 years ago, when there was no tall structures, probably there were no or very little upward lightning discharge. And this is quite interesting because, of course, now we have a lot of tall structures. And one particular type of tall structures is wind turbines, which are becoming taller and taller. And so, and we know that one of the main causes of damage of wind turbines are lightning strikes. And this is due to, of course, downward lighting, so they attract, I mean, some of the downward lightings are terminate onto one of the blades of wind turbines, but also, and most of the lightning flashes to the wind turbines are actually upward lightning that is initiated by the turbine itself.
All right, we're going to come back and talk lots more about lightning with our guests. 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the wonder and mystery of lightning, how it's both powerful and unpredictable. And you know, it claims the lives of more than 2,000 people around the world every year, not to mention the property damage. With me is IEEE Spectrum News Editor Amy Nordstrom, who's been reporting on new strides in lightning research this year, how researchers are getting closer to understanding lightning's origins and predicting lightning strikes. We've been talking this hour with Bill Ryson, Professor of Electrical Engineering at New Mexico Tech in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who's had to leave us this hour, and Dr. Varhard Rashidi, a professor at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology and Lightning Research in Lausanne, Switzerland. When we left, you were talking, you just got in an idea about wind turbines and how the lightning travels up from the turbine blades up into the sky.
Right, absolutely.
Wow. So does that mean they are in danger if we go into a wind turbine society? We are in danger of losing them, or do they have protection on them?
They have protection on them, but it is becoming a challenging problem to protect them because actually until maybe 10 years ago, in order to design, let's say, an efficient lightning protection system, basically what people do, they look at the lightning incidents in the region the wind turbines are to be erected. And they look, for instance, at that region and they see that, okay, the statistics show that there are maybe 3-4 lightning flashes per square kilometer there. But the problem is that once the wind turbines are erected, these turbines, which should have been struck by lightning once a year or once every 2 or 3 years, they are struck by lightning 10, 20, 30 times a year. And this is because they are initiating this upward lightning discharges.
That is amazing.
And
so
yeah,
we have
absolutely
to find a way then of protecting these turbines better.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, this, and especially considering the fact that upward lightning flashes, they are characterized by different characteristics. Their electric current has different characteristics compared to downward flashes. And sometimes the lightning protection system is designed based on the on a characteristic of downward flashes.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, we have a lot
and
of calls. I want to get to them before we run out of time. Don't mean to interrupt, but there's so many people. First of all, let me go to calls that we've gotten during the week. Here is a question from Stephen in Sacramento.
I was wondering if we could harvest lightning for energy like we do for wind and solar.
And that is a common question we are getting today. Could we harvest electricity?
Actually, not really. Actually, lightning is not a very interesting source of energy. Actually, there's lots of energy in a lightning discharge. So each cloud-to-ground lightning involves an energy of more than 1 billion of a joule. But there are two problems that we face in order to use this energy. First of all, of course, there are lots of lightning discharges over the Earth. So we think that it's there is about 50 to 100 flashes to ground per second over the planet. So if we were able to capture all these lightning flashes, which is, of course, an impossible thing to do, but assuming that we could capture all these flashes, this would correspond to a maximum power available, which is quite significant. But there is another problem, is that most of this energy is converted to thunder, to hot air, to radio waves. And there is only a very small fraction which is available at the channel bay. So this the electrical energy that we could store and we could capture and store at the base of the channel is quite a small fraction of energy. And I think the total energy in a single flash, assuming it could be captured, would only operate a single light bulb for a few months or so.
Wow.
So it is not a very good and efficient way of harvesting lightning.
Well, Farhad, I know you have big plans next year to start triggering lightning actually up at Santa's Tower in the Swiss Alps at your lightning research facility. So how do you plan to do that, and why do you want to do it? Why are you interested in doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So perhaps I can say a few things about triggering lightning. So actually, one of the main challenges of lightning research is to obtain experimental data because of the random nature of lightning and the fact that inside high voltage laboratory, we cannot really reproduce lightning as Bill was saying. So we need to do experiment on real lightning. And there are different ways of obtaining data on lightning. One is the use of towers, tall towers, which are struck by lightning often, and so that's what we do. Another technique that has been used for decades is the artificial initiation of lightning using rockets. And this has been used for research purposes. So basically, this technique is based on firing of a small rocket, which trails a grounded wire. So we offer a preferential path to the lightning. So of course we have to launch the rocket when the electric field at ground is sufficiently high so that there is a good chance of triggering a lightning.
So you're doing Ben Franklin's experiment over again, just with
exactly.
a rocket instead of a kite.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we make that the lightning discharge goes to a specific point in the ground at which we have some sensors to measure lightning current, and we have lots of other equipment around to measure other things. So this is a way. Yeah.
And I want to bring in another guest to talk about predicting lightning, because while we can't yet predict lightning, we can detect it when it happens all over the world, including in the Arctic. It's not a common occurrence, but something that has happened repeatedly this last Saturday. I want to bring on one of the people responsible for monitoring lightning flashes around the world. That is Dr. Ryan Said. He is a research scientist in electrical engineering for the Finnish company Vaisala, which runs the Global Lightning Detection Network. Welcome to Science Friday.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So you help and maintain two big lightning detection networks, one for the U.S., one that covers the whole world. What is the point of that?
Yeah, so we continuously monitor lightning all over the world. And as Farhad was saying, there's a lot of lightning to monitor, 50 to 100 flashes every single second. And we do this by using networks of GPS-synchronized radio receivers. As Farhad was saying, each lightning flash has a lot of electrical currents, and they essentially act as broadcast antennas in the sky. And then we measure the radio waves that they emit at these remote sensors to locate where the lightning is.
And like Ira was saying, lightning was detected in the Arctic this last weekend, and I understand your network was involved. How common is that?
Yeah, the conditions for lightning in the Arctic are fairly unusual. You need warm, moist air and some vertical instability, and that's much more common over the tropics or in mid-latitudes during the local summer. That said, each summer we typically detect a few thunderstorms, in the Arctic region, but this one is really notable from the standpoint of how many flashes we detected. In fact, the global network saw over 600 lightning events within 600 miles of the North Pole. And that's over three times as many events as we've seen in any previous storm in that region. Although, to be fair, we only have records going back to 2012.
Mm. Let's go to the phones to Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
So, yeah, one of my favorite stories from my dad, who was a Navy pilot, is he was hit off of Lockerbie, Scotland, by lightning. Lightning actually entered the aircraft and propagated on the inside as a ball of either lightning or plasma, and then exited. How common is this? You guys ever heard of that before?
Wow.
Yeah. So ball lightning is a really interesting anecdotal phenomenon. It's usually characterized by some luminous ball, which is usually associated with a nearby thunderstorm. But interestingly, this phenomena hasn't been reproduced in a controlled experiment. So it's still an outstanding question in the lightning community.
Well, let me ask both of you. So it's safe if lightning hits a plane. We should not be worried if we're in an airplane. Farhad, about lightning striking it?
In principle, I think airplanes are well protected against lightning. And what is interesting is that every commercial airplane is on average struck by lightning once a year. And again, as for the case of, you know, tall structures which initiate their own lightning, most of these lightning flashes that strike airplanes are initiated from the airplane itself. That is, you can see that, from the airplane up, you have branches which are towards the sky, and from the airplane down, the branches are towards the ground, which indicate that the point of initiation of lightning was the airplane itself.
Wow.
Now, the traditional airplanes, which are made essentially of metal, they are very well protected against lightning. We know that metallic enclosures typically protect everything which is inside from the outside electromagnetic disturbance, whatever that could be. But today we are using more and more composite material.
And Ryan?
Because of that, the protection of, let's say, modern aircraft is becoming more and more complex and challenging.
Wow, that's a very interesting thing to learn. Yes,
Amy? And then, Ryan, I know lately you've been working on trying to measure another particular type of lightning called hot lightning for the first time. So what is that?
Yeah, the first thing to know about hot lightning is it's not actually any hotter than normal types of lightning, but it's called that because of its capacity to heat up an object that is struck. So a lightning flash to the ground consists of multiple current surges. They are called return strokes. They're very powerful, but they are very short. They last for less than about a thousandth of a second. And the difference with hot lightning is it has something called a continuous current that continues to flow for 10 to 100 times longer. And it's this sustained current that causes the extra heating. And actually, this can cause, you know, more likely to cause forest fires or maybe damage a wind turbine blade, to bring in a topic from earlier. And the problem is our ground-based networks aren't able to detect this continuing current. We can just tell where the impulsive part struck the ground. But now there is a new weather satellite that was recently launched that has a new lightning sensor that is able to detect these continuing currents. So this is really a game-changing opportunity for us, where now not only can we tell where the lightning struck the ground, but we can identify those that pose more of a hazard from the perspective of heating.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. We have a cut from Richard from Madison, Wisconsin, who sent us a story on our Science Friday Vox Pop app about a close call with lightning.
The craziest lightning I've ever seen, or I should say felt, struck me while I was holding an umbrella in a wide open parking lot. I felt some tug on the umbrella like static electricity, and it pulled me and the umbrella up, and the next thing I knew, I heard a very loud blam. I was on the ground, and there was a woman about 50 yards from me screaming, "Are you okay? Are you okay?"
Wow. Wow, Ryan, is that common? How come? How fearful should people be?
Yeah.
I mean, holding an umbrella in a parking lot during a lightning storm? Not a great idea.
Lightning is very dangerous and very high electric currents and voltages involved. And that most injuries happen not from direct lightning strikes, but from a lightning strike nearby. And that's because as the lightning channel starts to make its way towards Earth, when it's about 50 yards up or so, you can have these upward leaders that come up to meet it. And so there can be a pretty wide area where you have these electrical sparks coming up from the ground that can be quite dangerous as well. So that might have been what was happening in this case.
And Farhad, can you tell us a little bit about how lightning manifests in different kinds of weather? Like, you know, you think about heat lightning or you hear about thunder snow. What's going on there?
Yeah, you can have, I mean, generally lightning occurs within the thunderstorm, but you can have also lightning occurring in other conditions. For example, in volcano clouds. So you see, I think everybody has seen images of lightning discharge over different types of volcano eruption. It can also occur in a sandstorm. So there are many observations. So the same phenomenon that leads to the separation of charge in a thundercloud, similar phenomena can occur within a sandstorm and produce some lightning or lightning-like discharges. And what is also interesting is that lightning is not a only terrestrial phenomenon. It has been observed also on other planets. So we have optical and radio noise data that have been, interpreted to indicate that there are lightning discharges on different planets of the solar system, at least on Venus, Jupiter, I guess also on Saturn. So it can occur in different conditions, but of course the main condition is related to thunderstorm.
Ryan, how does a lightning rod protect you? I mean, how do we get protected, and does it offer a cone of protection around us?
Yeah, so as I was mentioning earlier, a lightning channel that's coming to the ground is going to make a contact somewhere. So the point of a lightning rod is it encourages attachment to the lightning rod itself, and then that is safely connected through some conducting mesh down to the ground. So if you have a lightning discharge that's going to happen nearby, it helps move that dangerous current in a safe path down to the ground and hopefully not strike another part of your structure and cause more damage.
Wow, so many questions, so little time. Thank you all for joining us today, especially Amy Nordrum, news editor at the IEEE Spectrum.
Thanks, Ira.
Glad you're appreciating thunderstorms now.
Like, I know, me too.
It's great. Farhad Rashidi, lightning researcher at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, and Ryan Said, research scientist for Vaisala. And thank you all for joining us today. Just a reminder, it's the last week of our book club. We are reading Jennifer Ackerman's The Genius of Birds. Catch up on all the great discussions we've been having at sciencefriday.com/book club. And if you're curious about crows, are you raring for ravens or just crazy for all the members of the Corvid family? Sci-fi friend Dr. Kylie Swift answered questions about funerals, grudges, other crow family secrets on Reddit this week. Check out sciencefriday.com/crows for highlights. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Feather. Today, we had production help from Lucy Wong. Our intern is Camille Peterson. And we had technical engineering help from Rich Kim, Kevin Wolf. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And, of course, we are active all week long on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and all kinds of great stuff about lightning up on our website at sciencefriday.com. If you want to read an old kid's book about lightning, you could read about the kite that saved the revolution. Isaac Asimov wrote about how his kite experiments, Ben Franklin's kite experiments, helped get us help from France. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.